Vermont Movement News publishes news and interviews with activists from Vermont and elsewhere with a focus on analyzing tactics. We seek to have discussions on the ways to change the world for the better. The opinions of people interviewed on Vermont Movement News are their own and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Vermont Movement News. Welcome to Volume 1, Episode 5 of Vermont Movement News. This episode features an interview with Red, who is present at Occupy/Decolonize Oakland, the infamous Battle of Berkeley, and the protests that deplatformed Milo Yiannopoulos. Be forewarned that there will be discussion of police and far-right brutality and violence. Welcome, Red, to Vermont Movement News. You have a lot
Thanks for
say.
Having me. Glad to be here.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you've done to combat the alt-right, starting in California? I understand you were at the legendary Battle of Berkeley. How did that play out? How did that come to be?
I no longer live in the San Francisco Bay Area, but I was living out there for about 9 years off and on, and was involved in a bunch of different anarchist politics and other protest movements. And then in 2016, with the election of Donald Trump, like for a lot of people all over the world, all over the country, it was a big game changer. And so there's a pretty, for folks who don't know, there's a pretty vibrant anarchist community and radical community in the Bay Area. And there were some public call-outs associated with that that I responded to. And so that was kind of how I got involved, with just trying to be a presence and join my comrades in, turning out to combat the alt-right.
So what were the tactics? How did people organize the resistance? Was it internet? Was it leaflets? What made the mobilization effective?
Well, build up to the events that I was involved with, were a couple of quote-unquote free speech rallies that were happening in Berkeley that had turned into brawls with local activists, but not quite on the scale as, I believe it was November 15th, 2017, the infamous Battle of Berkeley. I think it was a lot through, internet, social media, because before the quote-unquote free speech rallies, there was a number of actions at UC Berkeley against Milo Yiannopoulos, and a lot of that was organized through Facebook and through just like kind of a general call out through various networks. At the Battle of Berkeley, I heard about it. I think it was done purposely kind of on the down low through flyers. Quarter sheet flyers and an invitation. It was originally billed as like a community barbecue, community block party to counter the presence of the planned free speech rally. But that didn't really do it justice. I wasn't quite prepared for quite how intense things got that day. I don't think anybody was.
What groups were there to counter? To combat?
There, it was various unaffiliated anarchist folks. There was a group called By Any Means Necessary, which is a Maoist graduate student group and maybe even a cult at UC Berkeley. One of their leaders, Yvonne, I forget her last name, was very outspoken in a lot of media around this. But I wouldn't say they really represented the broader constituency of people there. At that point, this is before Charlottesville, so like the idea of turning out against the alt-right was still pretty unpopular, or like not a lot of people really understood why it was so necessary. So yeah, it was mostly just unaffiliated anarchists. There was people there from the San Francisco kink leather scene. I definitely remember some big, tall, handsome man in a leather jacket that said, Leather Daddy San Francisco 2018 or 2017, whatever it was.
Cool.
So it was a variety of folks from the trans community, but no like real organizations besides by any means necessary were on board at that point.
Did BAM lead the counter?
I mean, I think they like to believe they're leading everything. They definitely put themselves forward and were definitely some of the most aggressive people on the anti-fascist side in terms of just confronting people face to face and not being afraid to go right up to the what ended up being the first skirmish line.
Do you think their tactics escalated things unnecessarily, or were they correct in how they went about things?
I think things were going to escalate no matter what. You know, both sides showed up maybe not wanting a fight. Some people did, but definitely ready or cognizant of what was going to happen. And Berkeley police originally tried to like cordon us off and keep us separated with some plastic orange fencing with a distance of about 10 feet. And I don't think anybody wanted to stay inside the designated protest zone.
What happened?
So I don't think they escalated things, but they, part of their tactics, you know, they just throw themselves right into it. And
on the alt-right side, who was there? I know that Identity Europa was there, and Nathan D'Amigo's activities beating up a very much smaller woman were part of his demise on the alt-right. Can you speak to more to the right side of the conflict there?
Yeah, lots more organizations on that side. You had, you know, Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, In Fatigues providing security. Identity Europa was definitely there. Proud Boys were definitely there, including Kyle Chapman, the notorious based Stickman. There was a lot of folks from the Rise Against movement there, which for folks who don't know is basically a neo-Nazi fight club based out of Southern California. And they were definitely rip-roaring, ready to go, wanting to fight from the very beginning. You could see them all worked up, red-faced, with their skull masks. Berkeley College Republicans, I believe, were there. She wasn't quite such a figure back then, but the now infamous Amber Cummings was there. And then, like, bikers for Trump, or just, like, biker-type people, definitely showed up in an organized way, dressed as motorcycle bikers, you know, and probably some other folks I'm forgetting. I know some local media did some good job of documenting who was there. Shane Bauer got some really good photos of people doing Nazi salutes and to really like expose the fact that it wasn't free speech people. It was indeed a white supremacist rally.
Amber Cummings, can you tell me more about her? Is she a white supremacist? What is her ideology? How does she operate?
Amber Cummings, I forget the name of the group that she's involved with, but she's tried to put on a number of alt-right rallies. You know, like one was called like the Rally Against Communism or something like that. But she is a trans woman who, for some reason, marches with people who deny trans people the right to exist and violently target trans people. And even I remember this very poignant moment where somebody on the alt-right side was shouting at a trans person on our side and called them an abomination. And Amber Cummings was standing right next to this person and totally okay with that demonization, a fellow trans person.
Isn't she with Pink Pistols?
I would not be surprised. I know the Bay Area Pink Pistols chapter, even though at its base it seems great to have queer folks getting armed and trained, but my understanding is that their politics are very, very conservative, to say the least.
Well, except the Vermont chapter has been taken over by a far left person. We won't name the person.
Oh, right on. Yeah, I just I'm only familiar with the Northern California chapter, really.
Yep. Was the opposition to the alt-right at the Battle of Berkeley, was it effective, or could it have been done better?
I would say both. I mean, I think we drew our line in the sand and made a statement. The alt-right was definitely had a more organized as to what they did, and I can go into like the evidence I saw of that. We weren't very well organized. Like I said, I just responded to like a general call out. So I'm sure some people were crewed up, but there wasn't like a broader affinity group or spokes council or any way that I knew of that people were coordinating tactics and strategy and resources, all of that.
So is there anything more about Battle of Berkeley you think you should say?
Yeah, so, you know, definitely have your comrades' backs and watch out for people in the street. That's something I learned, and just like not to underestimate the seriousness of it all. It was a big blow to the morale of the Bay Area anti-fascist scene. Like, we felt like it was a defeat. In retrospect, I would say tactical defeat, strategic victory, or just important battle to be fought no matter win or lose. But, you know, I had a lot of friends who got really messed up when the alt-right charged our ranks and were beating people down, including someone who's like the tip of their finger is going to be bent, you know, significantly to one side for the rest of their life. Another person who had their entire hand broken and was hospitalized. So don't mistake like what the stakes are. Don't think that it's, you know, some romantic, you're just going to go out there and everyone in the black bloc is going to win automatically. Because, you know, I learned, one, that the alt-right, they're big, muscly, trained former cops, former and current cops, former and current military, just like unsavory people who have this set of skills that our community does not. And trying to go toe-to-toe, while necessary at points, can't be the only tactic to fight the alt-right in the U.S. Because we're never going to be able to win on that terrain of the sheer show of force street battling.
Yes, if it's muscle, but if tactics get escalated where people have equalizers, what do you think would be the outcome?
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing. It was like Berkeley police had confiscated everybody's quote-unquote flagpoles. So I guess it was good, kind of no, but, you know, we're kind of way more aggressive with people dressed in black with masks on. So our normal kind of equalizer of a stick or some sort of melee weapon, you know, we're stripped of those, which is like a good, maybe broader lesson. But just one more thing about that is just in terms of like the alt-right being coordinated. I know that Unicorn Riot looked through a lot of chat logs in the run-up to Charlottesville. I'm not sure how all of it was coordinated for the Battle of Berkeley, but there was this moment where somebody deployed a smoke flare, and I'm pretty sure it was on the side of the alt-right. Because they acted like they knew exactly what was happening, stood in a line, did a whole battle cry, and then charged. And for folks who've been to a lot of protests, you know, anytime there's any sort of explosion from a police projectile or smoke or something that seems like it's tear gas, that people have a tendency to kind of overreact and panic and start running. Even if it's just like a flashbang or smoke, there's no immediate danger. And I really think that the alt-right had, I don't know, maybe watched videos or knew that that was what we were going to do, because they threw the smoke flare, battle cry, and then like crazy charge through the smoke off the street into downtown Berkeley. And that's the moment where you see Jason Domingo and other people brutally beating that woman. And that was the moment when a lot of people got seriously hurt in that fray. And maybe had we stood our ground and had we not panicked when the smoke got deployed and stayed more densely packed as a group, they probably wouldn't have felt comfortable charging like they did. So yeah, that was kind of one of my big takeaways from that.
in Charlottesville, it seems like the people on the anti-fascist side may have learned that, because they did the same tactic. First, the NSM and the Nationalist Front, which is NSM and Southern Nationalist people, charged through the Black Bloc. But once they got into the park, they were sealed in. They deployed smoke grenades at the same way, except at Charlottesville, they just got thrown back. And for a while, there was a ping pong game with smoke grenades. But I guess this lesson needs to be learned more than once. And everyone who ends up combating the alt-right has to learn that lesson.
Yeah, and kind of tying it to what's going on current day, if you read about the tactics of the protesters in Hong Kong, they have like a specific chant, like 1-2-1-2, that they use to get people to slow down and to march as a group slowly so that they're not stampeding each other or acting panicked. So it's kind of interesting to see that folks had learned about, you know, learned that lesson and were applying it to this awesome movement that's happening in Hong Kong.
Yes. Many, many years ago, I was at an anti-racism protest in Philadelphia. It was the MOVE organization that had called it. And whether he's popular or not, I know that Reverend James Bevel has been accused of and convicted of some awful sex crimes. But that notwithstanding, he was a brilliant strategist for the civil rights movement in the 60s in the South. And we had a permit to march from 8th Street to City Hall. That's City Hall is about 14th Street and 8th Street. Normal marching until Bevel got there. Bevel freaked out when we were several blocks past 8th Street, and he slowed the march down incredibly. And it took hours to do like three blocks. That was an interesting tactic. Keeping people slow and together, I think, is a takeaway of that as well.
Yeah. Yeah, super important. And, you know, just if you're, say you're out there dressed in black and, you know, staying close and staying tightly packed with other people who are on that same level of engagement is like a safety thing. Like, even if you're just there to be anonymous and, you know, to march with people who are doing whatever, sometimes the alt-right will, like, you know, pick you out and attack you. And I kind of learned the hard way, like, if there's no one else around, you don't have anyone to back you up. So even if you're not so into the whole Black Bloc thing and all that entails, just being around those folks, you know that people will back you up.
One thing that worries me a lot in demonstrations where there's possibly alt-right is you have a demonstration, there's safety in numbers. Then people just scatter. They walk away in small amounts, and they get picked off by alt-right or other predators as they leave the protest. That happened at Charlottesville, in the parking garage, and it's happened in many instances. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, that's another good point. Thanks for bringing that up. Also, we saw in Berkeley and other places that police snatch squads are really popular. So basically, if you're on your way to an anti-fascist protest, the police will just pull up in a van, grab you, pull you into the van, and drive off, right? Just having one other person there to know that that happened and to know where you are is a really good thing. And, you know, oftentimes they'll just put someone through a ringer and re-release them. You'd see those snatch squads during Occupy. But definitely, that's a tactic to be aware of. Yeah, and as far as leaving rallies, I definitely never left a rally alone, just as a course of habit for any number of reasons. But from the Battle of Berkeley, like, I ran into, I think, three people that I knew, and I realized I knew them once they took off their masks, and I was like, oh, whoa, it's you. But then we all left and walked together, like a group of four of us, to the Long Haul Info Shop, if listeners know what that is, long area, long time Bay Area radical space. But yeah, it's definitely good to, like, leave with people for safety, but then also so you can, like, debrief with those people and kind of come down in terms of security culture, you all know that each other were there. And so that's kind of like a safe group to have that emotional or tactical debrief with. Like, hey, that happened. What do you think about that? Oh, I saw this happening. Didn't you? You know, just kind of doing that. And also just like, whoa, that was intense. Like, I'm glad we're okay. And just being with each other. I wasn't aware of that being so much of a problem in the Bay Area, but definitely you see it like in New York with the Proud Boys. And I know there's been lots of attacks on trans and queer folks in Portland over the past year. So yeah, just rolling with a small affinity group, even, you know, making it a habit of never showing up or leaving a protest alone. Having one person who, even if you're not right next to each other, that you're keeping track of each other and that you know the, like, that I wouldn't leave without the other person and vice versa, and that we'll keep finding each other and checking in. I think that's a really important tactic. As time went on and I thought about, and me and other longtime organizers were thinking about what the best way to support anti-fascism was, is we started working with younger comrades and less experienced comrades just to lend our vision, lend our experience, and kind of help walk them through it and give them confidence. And I increasingly found that that was a really important tactic in terms of bringing new people into the movement, keeping those people safe, and growing the movement, diffusing knowledge between comrades and different generations of comrades. And yeah, just lending, being like, hey, no, actually, we're not getting kettled right now. See, look, the police don't even have their helmets on, so they're just chilling. Don't freak out. And I found like that kind of just like basic advice, and I got a lot of great feedback from people about how they felt much better about being there, and they wouldn't have gone if they didn't have someone to go with, and they wouldn't have stayed as long as they did if, you know, they didn't have someone to keep them calm and kind of analyze the situation. So that was another kind of big takeaway from that period of organizing for me.
In D.C., the infamous rally after Trump's inauguration, the organizers had told everybody that the D.C. police would not kettle because there had been an agreement not to do that. So one of the things that, I don't know if everyone knows this, that happened in the rally, the January 21st rally, is that people were just blissfully going about their way saying, we're not going to be kettled. And then they got kettled. It's important to never trust the authorities to do what they say they're going to do.
Right. And that was a lesson that I learned, is that, yes, you can learn how different departments generally behave and what their policies are. But like those things are not set in stone and like can change depending on what sort of political pressure the police department is getting. And yeah, and just to be honest with people about, you know, this is how things have gone, but you can't take that for granted. It's super important. And then the other thing that throws kind of a wrench into that kind of planning is that a lot of times for large protests, police departments bring in, quote, mutual aid. It's funny that we both use that term, anarchists and the police, but they bring in mutual aid from neighboring departments. And those neighboring departments might not have the same crowd control policies, might not use the same, quote, unquote, non-lethal technologies. And we saw that in Oakland right after Trump got inaugurated, where basically Oakland police and San Francisco police have shied away from the use of tear gas specifically for quite some time in favor of like pepper spray and different projectile-based systems. But at that march, I got my first actual taste of tear gas after going to dozens and dozens of protests. So, you know, you never know what could happen. You never know when someone's going to defy policy. And you sure as hell can't trust the police and take them at their word.
One tactic I've seen that's interesting, I don't know if other people do this, is that people come in black block, but underneath they have civvy clothes. So if they need to go into a bar to escape, they can make themselves not Black Bloc if people are have been warned to not let the Black Bloc in or stuff like that. Have you seen this before?
I have. It was always in California's pretty warm, and kind of the layering of protest gear was always a constant struggle for me, figuring out what was best and what keeps you from overheating, what's too hot, etc. But yeah, eventually I remember this moment where, you know, the police made extra sure this was like a free speech rally. I want to say maybe in like November of 2017, but when the Berkeley City Council, the Berkeley mayor, the Berkeley police were like firmly in this narrative of like protecting free speech, and they had like cordoned off the park in advance all around so we couldn't get in. So anyways, the march ended up back at a park where the alt-right wasn't, and people were de-blocking, and yeah, people kind of make shield each other and hide behind towels or whatever. But then all of a sudden everyone was in their civilian clothes and looked very quote unquote normie, you know, looked like anybody who would have been on the streets of Berkeley. You know, they weren't wearing torn jeans with a black punk shirt or whatever, covered in patches. Like, they just looked super like anybody. And yeah, that's generally important because the police will target people leaving protests who they observed earlier doing something like throwing a rock, allegedly, or lighting something on fire, spray painting. They'll wait, and if they have an identifiable thing, like say a hat or a logo that you didn't properly cover up, they definitely will go after you when they have the opportunity, even if it was after the whatever act they were going after you for. So yeah, just being able to like blend in is super important. I found out that's a little bit hard when you're all sweaty and you have tear, pepper spray in your hair and, you know, just like, to take off your sweatshirt and have a t-shirt, but, you know, definitely important being able to melt in and out of the crowd.
Personally, I'm super identifiable. If I wear Black Bloc clothing, people will still know it's me because of my stagger and my cane. So it's, I ask these tactics of people that have more experience with them because it's ludicrous for me to try to disguise myself that way because people will know it's me.
Yes. And it's important to remember that it's even if you are in Black Bloc, people who know you can identify you from basically just your eyes. I had a moment during the movement for Black Lives where I thought I was super, you know, super ninja. I had my black flight suit on. I had my black balaclava, black gloves, black everything. And out of nowhere, someone that I went to high school with, who I hadn't seen for years, walks up to me and is like, "Yo, what's up?" And knew who I was on this 2-inch strip of my eyes. And facial recognition software is getting to the point. My understanding is that even a ski mask doesn't hide like the geometry of your face enough or whatever. So certain algorithms could figure out who you were from that. You know, I try not to be too paranoid about that. I guess one other thing I'd say about having civilian clothes is if you do need to like put on a bunch of layers or it's an elaborate thing and you can't, it's not warm enough or it's too warm to wear multiple layers, sometimes it's helpful to have like a very normal looking person with a backpack that you can just grab your stuff out of and then throw it back into. To work with somebody in an affinity group with like that, to have a support person.
We've talked about the Battle of Berkeley. We've talked a lot about tactics. What about what happened at UC Berkeley with the Milo protest? Do you have stuff to say about that?
Yeah, that was an interesting day for sure. Folks who live in the Bay Area know that UC Berkeley kind of exists in its own little world. Where a lot of things are really campus focused, and I know it's its own entity. I showed up late to that event it was like, I learned a lot from this protest. I showed up late to that event because I was rolling up with someone who I went to a lot of protests with just to keep each other safe. And he was late, and then we were taking the train, and we had to walk. So I showed up like 40 minutes late and not aware of what had already happened. So what had already happened is that enough people had gathered outside where Milo was going to speak that they had called off the event. In addition, there were some folks in black. I don't know if you want to call it a black block, but some folks dressed like ninjas who like burnt a light pole and like broken some windows of the bank that's attached to the Amazon Student Center. And so when I showed up, everybody was super hyped up and I wasn't really like aware of the emotional level of everybody else. And I was wearing this hat that was put out by the rapper B. Dolan that says, make racists afraid again. Uh-huh. And I thought, oh, this is a great hat to wear to this event. Like, everyone's going to think it's hilarious. Like, you know, we're co-opting back the MAGA hat. But people just like did not see the text. All they saw was a red hat. And I eventually took it off because I was about to get jumped a couple of times. And like people were really on edge. So I guess the lesson there is just kind of be aware of the emotions that you're walking into. And that was also the first time I would see these kind of, I don't know what you want to call them, like right-wing provocateur martyrs who like come into a crowd and start, you know, trying to rip someone's banner away or their sign or like start some trouble and then act all surprised or that a bunch of people jump on them and start attacking them, you know, defending themselves, trying to drive this person out. So I started to see that a lot happen. You know, you see that now with that that Andy, I forget his last name, the white supremacist live streamer who made himself a martyr and then cried to Tucker Carlson about Antifa giving him brain injuries. The alleged concrete-filled milkshakes. They should really stop giving us so many good ideas, right?
Yeah.
So we shut down the march or shut down Milo's speech, and you have this kind of odd mix of local, like Berkeley students, concerned Berkeley students, because at that time, Milo Yiannopoulos was doing a lot of outing of trans folks at campus events and really making them targets. And so a lot of people at UC Berkeley, for a lot of reasons, really didn't want Milo to speak. So we shut him down. And then I don't know exactly, the march kind of got us started organically. Like, it was kind of clumsy how people were trying to get people out of there. I'm sure people in a lot of areas would love something like this, but it's called the Brass Liberation Orchestra. And it's an all volunteer brass street orchestra that comes and plays like Bella Chow and other anti-fascist songs and lots of great klezmer music and really helps like bring high energy to marches. So the BLO, Brass Liberation Orchestra, and other folks started out on a march. I would call it a snake march through Berkeley. And that kind of, once it got going, you know, once people see other people leaving, they're more likely to go with them. And what was notable about that protest in my mind is that the property destruction, which I'm generally okay or indifferent to, people do what they want and I'm okay with that, even if I'm not going to engage in that tactic myself. But the property destruction was really focused on just banks and Starbucks. Starbucks usually gets smashed up and we all get snacks and some coffee drinks. And that was really interesting. And like during the protest, people were kind of talking about like the action logic or why it made sense to be targeting banks and how, you know, a lot of the banks are supporting Trump and bankrolling other white supremacist organizations. So that was really interesting. That was also the march that I referenced earlier of about, you know, staying close to people. Like I wasn't even in Black Bloc, but I was masked up and having fun, got caught up in the moment. And, just like dragged a sandwich board sign from some shop out into the street, right? And just threw it in the middle of the street, not destructive, not violent, not really a big deal to protest, right? But I think some Berkeley College Republicans, I think that's who they were, took exception with me moving that sign. And one guy was getting up in my face, and then his friends were like, three of his friends were keeping him back. And I was just like, whatever, dude, come at me, bro. And then he punched me in the face. He came at me, sucker punched me from behind his friends. And, you know, kind of knocked me down. I was dazed and I got up and they'd gone. So that kind of shows you exactly how courageous these alt-right folks are. There's four of them, one of me, and they sucker punched me. I was on the ground and they still ran away. But I got up and got a pretty nasty black eye and maybe a concussion. Definitely shook up and, you know, kind of looked back and was like, man, I should have just stayed with the Black Bloc folks and like marched with people who I knew would have my back and help keep me safe. And yeah, so that was just like a pretty high energy snake march, and I think hopefully helped like radicalize some UC Berkeley students. But it kind of, I don't know where the police were. That was the other odd thing. It's normally like the police stay right on you and do a pretty good job of keeping marches contained. But for like an hour and a half, the march kind of had free rein through Berkeley, which is unusual. And I think kind of just speaks to how unprepared both the UC police department was and local cops and local politicians as like what a firestorm that whole alleged free speech conversation brought up.
Not all our listeners are anarchist or familiar with the tactics. Can you describe, so we do have some liberal type listeners that I'm trying to have a discussion with them about tactics. Can you explain what a snake march is for them?
Yeah, no problem. So a snake march is an unpermitted march that has a non-linear route. So it can go a couple of different ways, but normally there's like a crew of people with a banner or and maybe a sound system at the head of the march who decide which way things are going to go based on, you know, their destination, based on where the police are blocking them, based on any number of things. But the idea is kind of that if you're not marching in a straight line, it's a lot harder to anticipate and stay ahead of the march to get into a kettle. And it's also, you know, if you're going a straight line, that will often kind of telegraph your plans to the police. And, you know, you're going straight towards the jail, they know you're going straight towards the jail. But if you take like all these other routes and go through side streets, and then it's a lot more fun, it's a lot more liberating, and also, you know, helps keep the police on their toes and really unable to position themselves a lot of the time to stop the march or to contain it in any way.
I've been listening to a lot of historical commentary about demonstrations and what their effects were, and that's basically what this program is about. Recently, there was an incident in Canada called the Lock Street Affair, where anarchists in Hamilton, Ontario, went after a gentrifying area, and they kind of smashed up some gentrifying businesses. And the backlash that allowed the conservatives and even the progressives to demonize anarchists horrifically, and they were actually liberals calling for killing anarchists. Was there a similar backlash after the Milo event?
Not specifically, but in Oakland, which is right next to Berkeley, for folks who don't know, and, you know, contiguous, there's no separation, they bleed right into each other. There was a lot of discourse around that, you know, probably going all the way back to the Oscar Grant protests in 2010, I want to say. But in my experience, definitely going back to Occupy Oakland and then during the movement for Black Lives, it came up again. For folks who don't know, after the non-indictment against Darren Wilson, the murderer of Michael Brown, was announced. You know, things popped off all over the country, but it really began about 2-3 weeks of solid every night street protests throughout the San Francisco Bay Area. So I remember distinctly that all these car dealerships in downtown Oakland on what's called Broadway Auto Row got smashed up, and they eventually stopped replacing their windows and just put up plywood with spray painted messages like, "Hey, Mayor Libby, shave, whatever, stop the protest," whatever it was. And that was a thing. So it's kind of a constant dialogue in the media around social movements in the Bay Area. And yeah, I mean, I think it's like a tough issue, as I'm sure you'll understand, because you want to support other people's autonomy. But also, I'd like to advocate that, you know, for greater thought about if a tactic is strategically sound, right? And not like a tactic can be successful, like you smash the bank window, mission accomplished, or you shut down the Milo protest, mission accomplished. But just thinking about like a broader strategic framing of that, of whether it helps attain your strategic goals. And that's a conversation I continue to have with me and in my head and amongst friends. But I know the Bay Area is kind of its own monster, you know, like the public sphere in the Bay Area, I would say, is much more progressive or radical than other places in the U.S. So I think a lot of people kind of could see through the lies, or like see that it's a smokescreen, and that really, say, Oakland police are doing a lot more harm to the community by incarcerating and murdering innocent people than, you know, these the Clorox building in downtown Oakland getting its windows broken. So my impression is that a lot of people would see through that. At the same time, definitely other people would parrot, I've heard parrot, like, "Oh, it's too bad the Black Bloc showed up at Occupy Oakland and ruined things for the rest of us," when really the Black Bloc was the march, you know, like it was an anti-capitalist march, and that people there were on that level and didn't ruin anything for anyone. They, you know, exercised tactics as autonomous individuals.
I was very much a fan of Occupy Oakland. I was in Occupy DC, and one of the more unpleasant conversations was when Chris Hedges went after Occupy Oakland as the cancer of Occupy. Do you want to speak to that at all?
Yeah, I remember that moment distinctly. That is when Chris Hedges was no longer welcome in the streets of Oakland after that and got shouted down a lot. But you know, I would say that for folks who were there, like anarchists and radical folks and, you know, communities of color were the people organizing Occupy Oakland. Like the leadership, quote unquote leadership, the spokes council, the people who were bottom lining the info tent and everything were anarchists or radicals. They were open about that. They had an open discourse about whether to call it Decolonize Oakland or Occupy Oakland. So that was definitely the flavor. So I take exception with like this outside agitator point of view, or even like calling these people agents provocateur, like saying that they're police that were sent to make everybody look bad. All of that is just kind of what they, how they say, a red herring, you know, it's just they're distractions and they're not accurate. And once you're on the ground, you can kind of see how that inaccuracy is. And also that, like, the police don't need an excuse. They don't need somebody to do something for them to attack protesters. They attack protesters unprovoked all the time. And they take illegal crowd control actions all the time. And they're aggressive and brutal all the time. So the narrative of, like, you know, somebody breaks a window and then bam, like automatically the police have this magic ticket where they can do whatever they want. Like they always have that magic ticket and they will do whatever they want. And they, you saw that at Occupy Oakland as they're clearing out the camp. They hit Scott Campbell with a rubber bullet or a tear gas canister in the head and then threw tear gas at the people who went and tried to rescue him.
Horrific moment.
Yeah, actually, I don't want to say journalists, but yeah, you remember that moment. Scott Olson, there we go. For folks who don't know, he was part of Iraq Veterans Against the War and was at Occupy Oakland, and thankfully did not suffer like too bad permanent damage, but was specifically targeted and shot in the head with some sort of quote-unquote less than lethal round at Occupy Oakland during like a really brutal crackdown. So there's an example of people who are peacefully occupying and camping out and, you know, exercising their First Amendment speech, and the city comes and just starts tear gassing people, throwing flashbangs, beating people, you know, out of nowhere. And there was actually more of a backlash to that than there was, I would say, to anything else that happened in Occupy against the police, because that's when the police were super brutal, unprovoked. That's when Occupy Oakland called the November 2nd general strike that shut down the Port of Oakland, which is the third largest port on the West Coast, a major logistical site for capitalism. And they shut that down with like, I want to say 30 to 50,000 person march, like the biggest march I've ever been a part of, you know, with in general strike and with the support of the ACLU or AFL-CIO and the Port Workers Union. So that was probably the biggest backlash I can think of, any sort of like quote unquote violence that happened during Occupy Oakland.
You have to play chess. You can't just make your move. You have to try to anticipate the counter move. And that the police made a very wrong move by making a martyr, basically.
Yeah, and then it became impossible. Like, they had to step back. And Occupy Oakland just came back and reoccupied the plaza within 2 days, you know. Big gaffe on their part, for sure. Almost as bad, I guess the other big backlash during that time was that Occupy Davis, at UC Davis, which is near the Bay Area. And there was the, you know, people linking arms, sitting down, blocking a sidewalk that you could walk around them. They weren't even really doing a real blockade of anything. And Sergeant John Pike, or Officer John Pike, who people started calling Sergeant Pepper, just walked past with bear spray, casually spray painting a whole line of people in the face with pepper spray, who were sitting with their arms linked. So people kind of got the idea that really the police are going to do what they want regardless of your tactics and how quote-unquote peaceful they are.
I've heard a lot of people more on the liberal side try to paint any property destruction or even blocking a sidewalk as violent or blocking a street as violent. How do you answer that?
Oh man, that was definitely a constant thing in Occupy, that dialogue, that discourse. And we started calling those kind of people peace police because they're coming up to police your behavior, you know, to force you to be peaceful, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of a contradiction in terms, right? So I remember people just, like you're saying, like the most absurd things they would say, like, no, this is a peaceful protest. So like, man, one of the first moments in Occupy San Francisco, they were trying to raid the camp, and I'm like drumming on a top of a trash can, screaming like, fuck the police, whatever, you know, this is messed up, making a lot of noise. That's it. And immediately somebody comes up and like, they distract you and they lock you into like this dialogue and be like, no, this is a peaceful protest. So banging on a trash can, not even breaking it, making noise. I had somebody tell me I was throwing those little snap and pop, like party poppers that, you know, kids play with.
Uh-huh.
And they're really quiet. And somebody came up and was like, you know, I'm afraid that the police are going to mistake that for gunfire and start opening fire. So if you could like stop doing that, that would be great. And which is just ridiculous. Like that doesn't sound like gunfire. The police couldn't even hear it. but there was like such an impetus to police other people's behavior. I had someone who was an undercover cop, I was pretty sure. I was standing up on a windowsill waving a flag, and I was told that they were scared that I was going to escalate things. And it's like, oh, geez, escalate things from waving a flag, huh? Like, what's next? A banner or a sign or, you know? So it's kind of became this, yeah, any kind of boisterous or anything could potentially be called peace police. You would see this more, or would get called violent, or, you know, against the consensus for a peaceful assembly or whatever. But then you even would have people who say people are breaking the windows at the local Trader Joe's, come, you know, not hurting any person or living being, hurting a window, and then come up and attack that person. You can tell these people had never been to a protest, because then they're surprised that other people show up and defend their friend who was breaking the window, or defend whoever was breaking the window. And so at that point, it's like, okay, so you want things to be peaceful, so you're physically attacking people to make sure things are peaceful. You know, it's this very poorly guided, nonsensical viewpoint, enforcing some invisible creed that, you know, marching and working with the police and going and asking nicely for your demands to be met are like the only acceptable tactics. And it just seems to be a way that really attempts to deflate and disempower social movements.
One thing I've been thinking about a lot, I listen to a lot of right-wing media, and I'm hearing the far right mirroring our language, mirroring our tactics, like Jared Taylor tries to make his own white-only intersectionalism, how white cis men are so oppressed because of that. What can you say about the fact that there seems to be what we say gets mirrored on the right, and how do we counter that?
Yeah, I mean, if the right got as smart as the left is, which is, you know, relative, but if they started taking security culture as seriously as we did and started mimicking our security culture practice, it'd be a lot harder to dox them. You know, it would make a lot of anti-fascist work a lot harder. It is kind of interesting, you know, when you see the far right both simultaneously saying that racism doesn't exist, and that also Antifa is the real racists, are the real racists, you start to see, like, I don't know, it's a weird feeling when, yeah, you see people start talking about intersectionality, or I can't remember another example that comes to mind, or like, I don't know if you know about like the National Anarchist Movement, far-right people who call themselves anarchists and co-opt a lot of anarchist symbology, but, I mean, obviously nationalist and anarchist are not compatible by definition. Anarchists are against the state and are against nationalism, which would, prioritize one group above another group of people.
The National Anarchist Movement is a tragedy. The person who led it up was one of the organizers for Love and Rage many years ago, and something got twisted in him. I've read a lot of their material. They accept white supremacists. Basically, they want to break everything up into these little tribal units to make a more nice world. But basically, it just becomes a platform for the worst white supremacists who LARP is left.
Yeah, and they kind of, before my time in the Bay Area, they were kind of the fascist street presence we had to look out for, and they'd show up at May Day. The group was called BAN. I don't know whatever happened to them. They kind of have faded from the scene and were replaced by other types of fascists who we had to fight on the streets.
Yes. So what's coming up? What events are we going to be facing in the near future?
It's hard to say. You know, Trump like up until election night, I was sure Hillary Clinton was going to win. Like, there's no way Trump's going to be president. And here we are, you know, and it was kind of scary in the Bay Area. Like, within, took about 3 months after Trump got elected before we were openly street battling fascists. You know, it went from zero to whatever, infinity, zero to 100 so quick. It's hard to really say what's going to happen and what's going to influence what sort of situation. And, you know, I'm watching, there's like these different threads within progressive and radical social movements right now. Obviously, climate action's a big one, and there's lots of stuff going on here in Vermont around that. You know, high schoolers blockading streets in our capital, Montpelier. It was kind of inspiring to see, like, you know, that's the level of tactics for like a low-risk high school rally at this point. You know, like, high schoolers are into blocking the street when that wasn't always an acceptable tactic. So you see that, and different like pipeline stuff related to that. I know there's the Yellowfinch tree sit going on right now. There's striking coal miners in Harlan County, which is an area with a lot of labor history. That song, Which Side Are You On, was written about that area. So there's that kind of anti-extraction, anti-climate change stuff going on. But then I'm also really seeing that anti-ICE actions are ramping up. And I'd like there to be a lot more, but, you know, you're beginning to see more and more people shutting down ICE buildings and stopping ICE from detaining and deporting people kind of autonomously. And I'm seeing that movement start to gain some momentum. You know, even here in Vermont, we had an action blockading a building in Williston, Boston, Seattle. I know there was a big block party, Abolish ICE. San Francisco had a big block party last week. So those are kind of the currents I'm seeing. But like I said, it's really hard to predict or know what's going to come next in this weird, surreal moment we're in, where nothing, literally nothing, will surprise me anymore.
Yes. Well, I mean, I was thinking more of actual things. There's, Trump is coming to Manchester, New Hampshire on the 15th. There's this rally being planned in Boston, the Straight Pride. I think it's Resist Marxism. People are putting on. Do you know anything about what's going on with this?
Unfortunately, I'm not. I recently moved back to the area from California, so I'm not very well connected with movements in larger cities. I do see like a lot of potential for folks in the Northeast coming from the fact that you know, New Hampshire has such a disproportionate role in the electoral process with the first in the nation primaries, a lot of focus in town hall stuff, like New Hampshire's a swing state. So I can, and it's also like there's this, you know, kind of young, more liberal people, college students in New Hampshire, and then old, gristly libertarian and right winger New Hampshireites. So that I see has a lot of potential. You know, there's usually the presidential debates at Dartmouth College. That's kind of a opportunity in my view, just because of how much media spectacle is already generated around it. Yeah, but it'll be interesting to see what happens with the Straight Pride Parade, because folks might remember the last time there was a big alt-right rally in Boston, the police like kept them cordoned off in this one little area and then kept a huge buff, like 500-foot buffer between the many thousands of people who showed up to protest them. So hopefully it'll be another moment where they embarrass themselves with the low turnout. But yeah, I can't think of anything else really on my horizon. There's some anarchist book fairs coming up, the Boston Anarchist Book Fairs in November. Sometimes there's stuff that will happen around that. I know, like, the alt-right has been attacking a lot of radical bookstores and tried to attack the Austin Anarchist Book Fair, but was thrown out. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see and be prepared for to kind of seize the moment or respond to any eventuality.
Thank you. Well, I very much appreciate you taking all this time to talk with me.
Yeah, my pleasure.
This was Red from Vermont, New Hampshire area, and I appreciate the time. So that wraps up the interview. Thank you so much for spending the time with me.
No problem. Thank you, Maria. I had a good time.
And I'd like to talk to you more about later about the urban farming stuff, but I think it would just be way too much for this interview. I can hear you flagging a little bit on your end.
Yeah.
Coffee's wearing off.
Coffee's wearing off, and like, you know, another like real moment is that those street protests, even though I'm glad I went to them, like they carry a lot of emotional baggage, and I know a lot of people had a lot of residual trauma after the Battle of Berkeley, and you know, would get triggered and have symptoms of trauma when they saw, say, like a fascist at the farmer's market, and then they're right back there. So definitely like got my heart racing again, brought up, you know, some of that for me. So just a good reminder for self-care and being just like cognizant of the psychic and mental impact of being in these highly charged moments and traumatic moments, what that is.
Yeah, I have a rash on my back that I didn't have it before Charlottesville. I don't know if it's from a chemical burn or what, but I've been told it might be trauma, but my back breaks out ever since Charlottesville.
Wow. So just a reminder to take for everyone to take self-care super seriously, and also take care of each other.
Thank you. Have a good rest of your day.
All right. Thanks, Marina. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
If you like Vermont Movement News, please consider giving a donation to pay for new equipment and web hosting. We would very much like to purchase better equipment and possibly an additional computer system for our studio. We can accept donations through our Patreon at www.patreon.com/Vermont Movement News. Well, that about wraps up this episode of Vermont Movement News. I hope you enjoyed it. You can visit our website at www.vermontmovementnews.org. We are available on Blueberry, Google Play Music, iTunes, and other directories. We hope to add other platforms soon. Thank you.